Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Ben Rylan. On the program today, we'll be getting square-eyed with film critic Jason Solomons and TV editor for London Live, Toby Earl, as we discuss what's on the big screen and the small screen over the coming weeks. Plus, we'll have some French chanson by way of Manchester. And later on in the program, Fernando will once again pop in to spin his musical globe and we'll find out what's at number one elsewhere in the world. That's all ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Stay tuned. Jason and Toby, welcome both to the program. Now, let's get things started with a trip to the cinema first. Jason, if we were to head to the pictures this weekend, should we go and see the A.A. Milne biopic Goodbye, Christopher Robin?
Are you a Pooh fan? Winnie the Pooh, he adds.
That was very well phrased. Look, I am actually a fan of Pooh Bear, but I say this often and people sort of laugh at me, but I think you can tell a lot about a film by its poster. And there we go. There's the laugh. but the poster for this film, at first glance, you look at it and you think, oh, that's going to be quite sweet and mumsy and inspirational because you've got the two floating heads above the what presumably is a scene from the film. And that's a very well-trodden template.
Yeah, it's sometimes when they don't really know what the film's about.
Exactly.
It's not quite as bad as that when they kind of do every character that's in a film, like surrounding the title of the film, which kind of those posters...
Like the Brady Bunch.
There are some
credits.
People, and this is a film, and they're in it, yeah. And that's what the poster says.
Like the Spider-Man one earlier this summer, which was just ghastly.
They just don't know what they don't. They cannot distill the essence of the film, which is what a poster's supposed to do. That's why Saul Bass was so brilliant with his grand graphics, and he had Vertigo. It's like, ah, I see someone's falling off a building, and yet it's all about the kind of the modernism.
Absolutely, and then the poster for Baby Driver, or at least the ones we had here in London, all over the Tube Network, were fantastic.
Really
the
cool
French
ones.
Version was quite terrible.
The one with the car coming out of the gun.
Exactly.
That's really
yes.
Cool.
With the bright pink
colour
scheme.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. Mm. So, Goodbye Christopher Robin, no, they're not doing that. Because I don't think they're going for that audience. I think they're going for the people who kind of think things are sweet. It is very sweet, like A Jar of Honey, the film, I have to say. It is about Christopher Robin, but it's actually about A.A. Milne creating Winnie the Pooh. But there's not much Winnie the Pooh in it. He's a friend of Shepherd, the illustrator, and they kind of both come back from the Great War, the war to end all wars, as they keep saying, and of course with bitter irony, because of course it didn't end all wars. It's the Great War. It flashes back to their times in the trenches, and they're both suffering from what we would now call PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, where they're like the slightest pop of a champagne cork in 20s London sets them off on a guilty trip back to having survived the terror of the trenches. So you've got all that London stuff going on. A.A. Milne is played by Donald Gleeson. For some reason, I don't know. I mean, he did it great. He must have done really well to get the part and auditioned. And it's like, but he is Irish, you know, and he's done really well not to do the Irish accent. Donald did it in that quite bad Richard Curtis film, About Time, where he just kind of closed his eyes and kind of used to teletransport. And he did that kind of posh English voice. And he obviously went to the audition and sort of said, I'll do that one. And they went, brilliant, we love that. Can you do more of that?
So he plays very much of the moment, though, isn't he?
He's kind of hot right now, yeah.
Well, yeah, he's got a small role in Mother.
Yeah, he does. Does, in which he fights his own brother, Brian Gleeson, who I didn't even know they had a brother.
I mean, that was a very strange moment in a very strange film. But look, he did a fantastic job in Ex Machina a couple of years ago.
Yeah, he was
too.
Brilliant in that. Yeah, no, that's when he was really good. But this one, he plays Button Down A.A. Milne, which is fine in the younger bit, but when he has to age, because it's one of those films that kind of stretches out, he just gets a bit of grey hair and a sort of bad makeup job and doesn't really work for me. But he does that button down thing quite well. And I didn't know A.A. Milne was that button down. You kind of think of this kind of lovely guy. Who kind of come up with this wonderful poetry and the stories of the bear. And so he's got this kid, Christopher Robin, who they call Billy Moon, and their nanny is played by Kelly MacDonald, and she's called Noo. It's all very kind of British. Everyone is in a chocolate box house. The mum is a different creature. She's called Daphne, and she's played by Margot Robbie. Very oddly cast. I think the mum, she was a bit of a sort of wanton figure who used to disappear into the London lights for a bit and kind of go and have wanton kind of affairs and a bit of flapping around. Everyone seemed to flap in 20s London, according to this this film. So she used to disappear, leaving him alone with the kid. And the kid is extremely cute, I have to say. And then they kind of play, oh, look, here's, this is your bear and this is your piglet. And they all sit around the table. And A.A. Milne has this light bulb moment. I see. There could be a great story here about a bear and a kid. So they kind of comes up with this Winnie the Pooh that we all know. Then, of course, it kind of fast forward a bit. And Winnie the Pooh becomes like, you know, cue montage of books flying off shelves and kind of transatlantic journeys and selling it in America. And it becomes very famous. Poor old Christopher Robin is kind of sort of wheeled out quite often to do interviews. Oh, you're the real Christopher Robin. Everyone wants to know you. So it's all of that. And then the Christopher Robin's only little boy goes, I don't really want to. I just want my daddy. So it becomes a father and son thing. Has he pimped out his child for the sake of literature that we all love? Was there the, you know, this terrible non-love story behind the story that we all love? And that's what the kind of thrust of the film is.
Perhaps they were wise not to choose that, has he pimped out his child, as the tagline.
It could have been, yeah, when we were young pimps. It is, you know, that bit, it does build up ahead of steam. I have to say, really nothing much happens. I mean, I've kind of told you it. There's no incident, though, at any point in it. And there's no drama, really. There's nothing going on there.
Well, it comes from a fairly clear-cut template, doesn't it? Because you've got the film about Beatrix Potter that was out a few years ago.
Oh, what, with Renée Zellweger stuffing tissues in her mouth like a hamster.
And then there was one about J.M. Barrie a few years ago as well, going all the way back to one that I recall that was about L. Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz. And I mean, that was a long time ago, but still, they all seem to be telling a story.
It's the stories behind the cherished stories that we love.
The stories behind the authors that are just a little bit uneventful, perhaps.
Well, I mean, it's not like they're writing Sympathy for the Devil. You know, it's not Exile on Main Street, is it? They haven't shacked up in a chateau or it's a broken...
Hallenberg.
Exactly, yeah, some crumbling down place, and they create a huge piece of art which kind of defines a certain period of modern culture. They haven't... I mean, that's clearly not what's happened.
Yeah, we're talking about Winnie the Pooh.
Exactly.
You know.
So you must think, and I'm assuming when you were sat there, James, you must be thinking, did they not think even, look, a little bit of artistic license, something to jazz it up? Were you kind of just frustrated?
Well, that's, I think, why they cast Margot Robbie and said, well, she even got so bored she disappears for half the picture. Don't ever dance.
What a contract.
But are we being a little bit harsh then? Is the whole point? If you look at the audience that this film is trying to appeal to, as we mentioned with the poster, it is going for that sweet and sort of daytime trip to the pictures sort of audience.
It is, and I'm sure
not really going in there for Requiem
still like
for a Dream,
Winnie the
are
Pooh,
they?
Do they? I mean, don't they just like Harry Potter?
Winnie the Pooh. Oh, yeah. Winnie the Pooh, although his thunder's been stolen a little bit by Paddington, you know.
Paddington's hot right now. That's the guy we're all after. But do we want to see Michael Bond sitting in his shed, kind of writing Paddington? Sometimes they're just not that interesting. The stories are behind creation. They're not, as Toby says, they're not tortured kind of like paths to this kind of, you know, I suppose hallowed turf that we all. And it is Winnie the Pooh, who is very sort of gentle and sweet and cute. And it's kind of like, really? And I was fantastically bored by it.
I mean, does the film even come close to explaining the creative process and why A.A. Milne gave Winnie a T-shirt and not trousers?
No, you're right. He doesn't mention that. It's true.
You know, that's a fairly common...
There is a bit of London
affliction.
Zoo not wearing trousers.
Well, you know, especially for bears, at least. You've got Winnie the Pooh. You've got... Well, Paddington only wears a coat, doesn't he? And even in Australia, we have... in Australia, we have Humphrey B. Bear, and he also does not wear trousers and found himself not on television for a while because of that. He also can't talk, makes it very awkward. Goodbye Christopher Robin is in UK cinemas right now. It will hit the US this October. Our second film today is Brimstone, something completely different. Directed by Martin Coolhoven, this Western thriller follows a bloody battle between a volatile preacher and a mute midwife, played by Guy Pearce and Dakota Fanning, respectively. Let's hear a clip.
Reverend says he's here to take you back where he came from.
I know you're there, and I know you can hear me. You may have no tongue, but there is nothing wrong with your ears. Do you know why I'm here? I'm here to punish you.
So, Jason, this film has a bit of an odd formula, I suppose you
odd
could say.
Odd accent from the sound of it.
Odd accent. But it's split into four parts, I understand.
Yeah, it's four parts that aren't necessarily... Well, they're not continuous at all. There's the first part, and you think, OK, I'm getting this, and it's Guy Pearce with a cicatrist face, and you think, he's no good, and he comes with that terrible accent. He comes into the sort of... we're a sort of Dutch settler time, the kind of Mormonish, Amishish community of early settlers in the West somewhere in America, and he comes in and... They're all kind of praying in their kind of clapperboard church. And he comes in and says, oh, hellfire will happen. And Dakota Fanning is a sort of midwife, and someone sort of gives birth to a child right there and there on the church floor, and she kind of is there to administer it. And the child survives, but the woman dies. And he then says, this woman is a curse. So they all have to kind of turn on Dakota Fanning. And you think, oh, that's fine. And then the second bit happens, and you think that's going to be the following. But no, it flashes right back to a kind of flop house in a kind of frontier town where all the kind of prostitutes are hanging around and the cowboys are getting bathed. All that sort of stuff you've seen before in the kind of saloon bars and all of that. And then, and Guy Pearce, much younger, without a scar, comes in. And you think, oh, OK, well, we're picking up where that happened. And then it flashes back again in the third part to Dakota Fanning and where she came from. And then in the fourth part, it all sort of comes back together again. And it becomes a tale of retribution in the Hard West. But it really, it's all about how women should be subjugated and used as prostitutes and kind of chained up with these kind of awful contraptions to keep them quiet and manacled. I think it's masquerading as a sort of feminist treat. I did hear the director kind of saying, no, but this is a feminist film, yeah? No way is it a feminist film, I've got to tell you. I don't think a Dutch bloke who is obsessed with kind of rape and pillage and fire and guns and stuff can make a feminist film. And it completely avoids him here. This is one of the most disgusting films I've seen. I felt like I needed to have a wash after it. I hated every single second of wow. Brimstone.
Wow, that is some review, Jason.
Yeah, he's lucky he got that as well.
I have read a few people say that this film is quite misogynistic, which, look, that is, to say that this is not a feminist film is one thing, to then go further and call it misogynistic is quite another.
Well, he will say that the times were misogynistic. You know, I'm only showing what was shown. I haven't done the research, so I don't know how it was out in the Wild West. I've seen Calamity Jane. I think it's probably not like that. But this is taking it one step, like, way too far. I mean, I think that women, of course, have been treated terribly and were treated terribly in those times. But this revels in that treatment. I think it's fine to show it, but I don't think we have to kind of go, oh, look, actually, it got much worse. Look at this bit. Hey, look. And they got raped. It really is, it's too long. It's 2.5 hours of it. And I don't think you can say by showing it, I'm empathising with it at all, because he doesn't let us do that. And it becomes ickier as it goes along. And I don't want to spoil it for. Actually, I do want to spoil it, because I don't want anyone to go and see it. I mean, this sort of evolving incest and a kind of love for your own progeny. And Guy Pearce is kind of actually ends up kind of, you know, pursuing his own daughter, it turns out, from some, you know, rape that comes back to haunt him. And so, yeah, look, that thing, your face, you don't want to see this. You really don't want to see this movie. And if film critics still has a job, it's to put people off seeing twaddle like this. But this is because this is harmful and ill-judged twaddle. It was actually in competition at Venice last year and at the London Film Festival. And I took the programmer Claire Stewart to task for even programming it. I thought it was that. And I'm not a censor as well. I don't think you should be banned. I just don't think it has any business being promoted as art at all, because it's one thing it is artless.
Brimstone is out in cinemas now, in case that review made you want to jump up and go and see it.
Don't blame me if you see it. Write in and say, yeah, I was wrong. If you write in and say I was wrong and that you really liked it, that's fine, but I don't want to see you.
If you do go and see it and hate it, you'll have to write in and apologise to Jason Solomons for not listening to him. Jason, thank you for taking us through those lacklustre films this week, actually. Before we move on to television with Toby, though, we're going to have a little bit of French chanson here on the Monocle Arts Review, all the way from Manchester. Yes, that's right. The Chanteuse, also known as Lucy Hope, is a leading francophone singer with a new album coming out in October called Sings Mondiano, inspired by the celebrated author. The songs are a mix of Gainsbourg, bossa and jazz, and Lucy stopped by Midori House for a chat with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Patrick Modiano is a French novelist, and he won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2014. He is just a very beautiful writer and writes mainly about the same subjects, which are loss and nostalgia and the presence of things that once were but no longer are, sort of the presence of absence or the absence of presence. It's always a running theme, really, through his novels.
And he wrote a lot of French chanson songs as well, so that's the reason why.
Yeah, little known. Actually, it's becoming much more known now that before 1970, in fact, he stopped in 1970, he actually did embark on a little bit of a career in songwriting, and he had a little bit of success with some songs for Françoise Hardy. So he wrote Étonnez-moi Benoît, which was on, you know, her number one album. And he wrote also for Régine and a few other kind of quite big stars of the time. But it, I don't think he ever thought it of any, as anything very serious. It was always a kind of a bit of a hobby that he did with his friend from school. That said, the texts themselves are beautiful.
You mentioned some of the recordings were quite rare to find as well. So I guess besides singing, you also had to do quite a few, lot of research.
There was a lot of digging to unearth them. That's true. Yeah. So, well, actually, one of these songs is called A Cloche-Pied sur la Grande Muraille de Chine, which is one-legged down the Great Wall of China. And actually, that was a translation from a song that an already existing song in English called Soon as Slipping Away. And Françoise Hardy wanted that translating into French, and Modiano did, but it wasn't really a translation. It was a completely new text to that music. And unfortunately, it was only ever... Well, I always thought it was released on a rare Brazilian LP that was only ever released in Brazil, talking of Brazil with you. Mm-hmm. But then I read recently that it was South African. So I'm not entirely sure whether it was a South African LP or a Brazilian LP. But either way, it was never released in Europe. And so that's made it quite mythical. People, you know, huge Françoise Hardy fans were always on the search for it and trying to find it in old record stores.
I like to ask you as well, because, you know, I also find out that you also have a psychedelic rock band.
It's true.
Yeah, you're quite versatile. Tell us, how do you deal with both rhythms? I mean, fairly different, I may say.
They are fairly different. Do you know what? It's all about character. You kind of, with my rock band, I very much get into a different persona when I'm performing those songs. And the same with the chanteurs. You know, it's a character to sing, you know, to be this English girl that sings in French. You just put a different hat on, I suppose, metaphorically speaking. But the songs for the House of Glass, I write them myself, so it feels a lot more kind of personal, and I can identify with it a lot more. But with the chanteurs, same thing. I only chose songs for this album that I could personally get inside of and relate to, because there were quite a number that he wrote that definitely weren't songs that I could identify with, and therefore they didn't make the cut, as it were.
What are your main musical influences, would you say, you know, besides the main French chanson singers?
Yeah, everything. I'm just very drawn to the tragic in certainly in vocalists, so, you know, kind of a dark side, whether it be to the character or something that you think you can perceive in the voice or the breath between, you know, the words. So singers like Karen Carpenter or Dusty Springfield, I don't know whether it's because you know of their story that their voices sound like they're so sad, or whether their voices have that within them anyway, I don't know. But I'm always drawn to those kind of more sad and more meaningful musicians or artists, as opposed to like the just kind of straight pop, I suppose.
Well, before we end the interview, we'd like to give a taster to our listeners. So if you could choose one song from the album that we can play us out, which one would it be?
I would say, because it's good fun and good jamboree, I would go for, it's got kind of lots of gypsy influences, go for L'Aspirateur, which is the second single off the album.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
That's
merci.
Lovely. Merci. Que sont devenus mes amants, Baba Kara, le grand amant, la 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 la. Beau veston, Pépé, le moco, et le marquis de Mikado, la 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 la.
That was The Chanteurs speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. For more information, go to thechanteurs.co.uk. You're listening to The Monocle Archiview. I'm Ben Ryland, and I'm in the studio with the film critic Jason Solomons and the TV editor for London Live, Toby Earle, who we turn to now to find out what's happening on the box. Toby, let's begin with Star Trek Discovery. This debuted in America on the CBS network last weekend. It's just hit Netflix here in the United Kingdom as well. Now, it's a bit of an interesting setup, isn't it? Because it debuted on CBS, but it's actually made especially for their online platform, CBS All Access, which one would assume is going to be quite an American-focused thing, but no, they're expanding this globally as well, aren't they?
So, yeah, so I mean, we could talk about the production of Star Trek Discovery for a good hour or more, because it's been, I think, fair to say, troubled in its inception and its transit to screen. But yeah, it's on CBS All Access, their streaming service. And because this is such a blue-ribboned piece of intellectual property, they wanted to absolutely make sure that this was going to be done right. And also, it's really, you could argue, a business decision to place it upon that streaming service in order to give the streaming service some heft so they can start competing with Hulu, Netflix, Amazon and the like. So even though you would think this is absolutely prime network territory, they're thinking must be that this is the kind of programming we can place on a streaming service for the younger audiences to bring people to it as well. So yes, it's available in the UK on Netflix, and I will start with some good news, because there are some people out there who have studied Klingon, have taken degrees in Klingon, and they've thought maybe, have I wasted my time? Maybe they had a couple of nights, they thought,
Toby,
have I wasted my time studying Klingon? Well, guess what, guys? You haven't. Because you can watch this in Klingon. There are Klingon subtitles. So they've really thought about this. And I do love the fact that they have actually thought about this.
Did you watch them with the Klingon subtitles on?
Sorry, there's something in my throat. No, I did not. I mean, although, however, if you do watch it, if the Trump subtitles were available, it would essentially just be this Klingon shouting, make Klingon Empire great again. That is basically the nub of the storyline. But it's had a troubled, like I say, a transition to screen. Lost showrunner Brian Fuller. It was originally meant to come out in January this year. It's now, of course, not January. They're actually holding about half the series back until January next year as well. So people are thinking, oh, gosh, this is concerning, because this is Star Trek. This is one of the biggest, not just science fiction properties in existence, but one of the biggest TV properties in existence. So what it feels like in these first two episodes is that they are balancing the J.J. Abrams lens flare fiesta with some old school Star Trek sounds, because they've got the doors and they've got the swishings and the sounds of everything moving, and it's absolutely as it should be, because this is set 10 years. Star Trek Discovery is set 10 years before the original series.
Just 10 years.
That's the thing. Just 10 years. Now, what I can't get over, and this is a really minor point, by the way, because there's a lot good about it. The technology is better in this than it was in the original series. And I don't know, was there some kind of dip in, like, did they kind of like have a factory reset and everything kind of went back a few years?
Toby,
I know, it's a tiny point.
When they bought the old Nokia, out again.
Yes.
3310.
Exactly. Whatever. Snakes in Colour. Oh my gosh.
There will soon be a reboot of the Will and Grace sitcom in which takes place in some sort of make-believe time loop where nothing actually happened. I think we need to, you know, move beyond specifics in the world of television.
You're talking, move beyond specifics in the world of Star Trek? Are you insane?
So there's no Captain Kirk?
There's no Captain Kirk. So what you do actually have is Spock's father, who is the adoptive father of the lead character played by Sinequa Martin Green, who you recognise from the Walking Dead. She plays a character called Michael Burnham. That's the name of her father, who was murdered by the Klingons. I mean, Jason Isaacs is in this, by the way. He plays the captain, but we don't even see him in the first two episodes. I'm not giving too much away here, because the first two episodes rock it. And no pun intended there, but they absolutely hurtle as they set up this cold war between the scattered Klingon Empire and the Federation. And it all centres around this broken, damaged satellite station, this relay. Who's done it? Why have they done it? And it sets it up very nicely, because it introduces quite a few of the cast. We know that not all the cast are going to survive, because we know they're not going to survive, because what happens across the course of these two episodes, a fairly epic space standoff. There's a Mexican standoff, and it just escalates into all-out conflict. But what is interesting is how the show actually starts. It doesn't start with Starfleet. It doesn't start with us standing in the bridge alongside Sinequa Martin Green or Michelle Yeoh, who plays the captain of the first ship that we find ourselves aboard. It starts off with this Klingon giving this really impassioned speech about the idea that whenever we see these humans, they say this lie, we come in peace. And this whole sensation of us sort of seeing it from the opposing side, quite a nice touch.
One thing that people will say about the old Star Trek,
yep,
is that this is fiercely intelligent television. This is one of the cleverest programs to ever be broadcast on television.
Sure. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And not many of the modern interpretations beyond that have really attracted the same level of praise. Where does this one sit?
I think you're always, the Next Generation was brilliant, and I was a massive fan of Star Trek Next Generation. I think that, you know, that benefited from such a long period between the previous, the original series and that. And there
was like 25 years.
I mean, such a huge period of time. People were really thirsty for it. The subsequent ones, I think, had more of their niche fan bases. Still, many of them really like Voyager, less so. Enterprise, even less so, I believe. But this one, this one has zip, and it has a purpose to it. It has some great visuals, by the way. I mean, it really competing here with blockbuster TV as well as cinema. I think the casting is interesting with Sinequa Martin Green, Michelle Yeoh in there, like I say, Jason Isaacs. This is a side issue, by the way. You've got Anthony Rapp playing a character called Paul Stamets, who is the first openly gay character in the Star Trek universe.
And I thought that was Zachary Quinto.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. It was Sulu. It was in Star Trek Beyond was portrayed as a gay character.
Right.
But they're actually going to they're diving deeper into
and
the
George. What's his face?
George Takei.
George Takei.
Oh, I mean the characters. Sorry,
are they real? Are they characters? They're all rolled into one. It's one big convention for me.
They've got ambition. It's got ambition. Also, it's only being rolled out weekly, so it's not a binge watch. It's going to be an episode a week. That's how we'll watch it, both in both in the States, but also in the UK as well. I have high hopes.
You would imagine that with the brand name CBS All Access, it's going to be quite American focused, but they are planning on rolling out a localized version in Australia, of all places, fairly soon, and not to mention other parts of the market as well, global market. Do you see this as batting on a similar playing field to maybe Amazon or the Netflix of the world?
Well, the CBS name has no real cachet in the UK. And I would say that most people, if you put something in the street and ask them what CBS is, they probably think it's either some low-budget supermarket or CB radio. I don't think it has that cachet.
But there are free-to-air networks here that do carry the CBS name. Okay, so they're just like, the horror channel or whatever it is. But
they do have action and drama and things like that.
There are many other parts of the world where CBS means literally nothing at all, and yet they're still using that brand name. It's a very curious choice. One would imagine that some sort of catchier name might be coming up relatively soon.
First and foremost, they've got to start competing with Netflix and Amazon, and in the UK with the iPlayer as well, because that we're talking about, those are the ones that really are market leaders. That's a tough nut to crack, and that's not even in their home territory. They have to get this absolutely right, because it's not free, by the way, in the States. It's $9.99 for streaming and $5.99 a month in dollars, rather. So it's not even if it's like I have CBS already, so I get this on the side. I have to pay extra.
Amazing that you say that, Ben, that there are parts of the world where CBS means absolutely nothing at all. But you imagine going to the heads of CBS and saying, look, guys, there are some places that have never heard of you. They're like, what? We're CBS? We've got a big building in the middle of the strip, and we've got records and everything. And then you say, no, we don't heard of you. I mean, their egos would be so damaged.
Well, I think they would. They just bought one of Australia's three free-to-air television networks. And still, there are a lot of Australians that are scratching their heads wondering, what is this CBS? How do they afford to buy Channel 10.
Listen, your Bears don't even wear trousers. Yeah. You're in no position to
It's quite hot, though, to be fair.
He wears a vest. Star Trek Discovery is available on CBS All Access in the United States and Netflix here in the UK right now. Now, finally, we have a new BBC Three drama called Overshadowed. That's coming up next month. Toby, tell us, what is this one all about?
This is a really interesting piece of programming from BBC Three. This is a short-form piece of programming, so there are only 8 episodes, and each episode is 10 minutes long. Tells the point of view story of a vlogger, called Imogen, who decides she's going to start vlogging and she's going to record her attempts to kind of get a bit fit and so daily social life, as vloggers tend to do. Imogen's played by this young actress called Michelle Fox. But what happens in the course of the self-recording is that something starts to appear on camera. And this deals with eating disorders and it deals with mental health. And it's sinister. I mean, it's properly sinister. And referring to Netflix, 13 Reasons Why to the Bone have garnered quite a lot of criticism for their portrayal of eating disorders and mental health. People saying they're criticising it for being full of triggers and romanticising, glamorising even suicide and just some of the most devastating states people might find themselves in. I've interviewed Michelle about this, speaking to her about the sensitivity required for a piece like this. I do not find it in any way glamorous or romantic when it's dealing with a young girl struggling with an eating disorder. I don't want to give away how it portrays this eating disorder, because I had to re-watch episodes from the start a couple of times because of the way it manifests itself. It is creepy. You might sort of look towards maybe Jason, something like Repulsion or that kind of...
That's high praise indeed.
Something like that in terms of how it kind of presents that sort of split.
I'm thinking of the TV, was it Cyberbully, the one-off drama?
With Maisie Williams. Yeah. It's not quite a one-hander, because there are people on camera, her sister every now and again, but yeah, exactly that kind of thing, that sense of isolation, which, funnily enough, that's not what vlogging is about. It's about sharing everything with everyone, but at the same time, of course, you are just, automatically yourself talking into a camera, although you are essentially alone capturing yourself. But I don't really want to give too much away to you or to anyone listening, because, like I say, how it presents... the attack someone comes under from the sort of destabilisation of mental health is really quite unsettling. And like I say, it's the kind of thing that you all go back and go, hang on a minute, where have I... So when did that start? And you'll go back and you think, OK, well, that... Oh, it started there. Go back. Oh, no, it started there. And you don't notice where these things start. And that, I think, is a really fascinating way, because the character themselves doesn't know either. So you are, in some ways, then playing detective, thinking, when did it all start? How did it all start? Like I said, Jace, it's almost a one-hander, but there is a young cast. It feels very true. It's shot, you know, she's like she's holding it. She talked about the whole rig and how she'd been having to film it. It's quite tricky because you've got a cameraman filming her and everything.
And each episode only goes for 10 minutes, doesn't it?
10
so
minutes,
it sort
yeah.
of takes the form of an actual video that's been posted online.
Exactly that. So yeah, when
and BBC Three is online only as well, so it quite suits the medium.
Perfectly. I mean, perfect for the demographic, perfect for the medium. When all eight episodes are released, you will watch it in one go. I mean, it's an hour and 20 of your life, and you will watch it in one go, and you will re-watch it, because, like I say, you will want to see how they seed the beginnings of Imogen's deterioration. I've sort of spoke to her, and she was saying how shocked people were on set when they saw her towards the end, where she's truly struggling with this illness.
She does the whole De Niro thing.
Well, she doesn't kind of go too method, but she doesn't look well at all. And there's no glamorization.
Do we know? I don't know Michelle Fox. Is she one of the Foxes?
She's a young... No, she's a young actress. This is kind of one... Probably, hopefully, might be a bit of a break for her.
So then, when you said you want to watch them all at once, has BBC released all of the episodes all at once?
They will. On the 1st of October. On the 1st of October. They'll be all... they'll be released in one go. And yeah, it is, like I say, it's sinister and it's creepy, and it's... I think it's a pretty adult way of addressing these issues.
Sometimes these films about the internet are made by sort of old commissioners. Because well, we do something about... I've read about these vloggers. Yep. Let's do something about that. Yep. It sounds actually that the people
pretty
behind
sure
it...
vlogging isn't a word anymore either.
What are they called now?
I think it's just posting a video.
Right. Influencers.
Yeah. Right, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Influencers, oh God.
So yeah, I mean, the screenings for that would be really weird. Everyone just kind of hashtagging hashtags.
Yeah.
So, but it feels like people who are empathetic with the kids rather than people trying to be down with the kids on this.
Absolutely. Kay Mellor's involved, and so this is someone with a track record, of course, for writing about issues and writing not just well but also for a popular market, which is important because, of course, you've also got to make sure this connects and lands with people. So I think it's a fascinating project, and I think the short form nature of it lends itself to telling a story in a really punchy way, which doesn't outstay its welcome but also leaves you thinking quite hard, and also allows you to rewatch and rewatch and rewatch, because I think there is repeat viewing value in this.
Overshadowed will be available on BBC Three this October. Thank you for talking TV with us today, Toby. Now, of course, it would not be the Monocle Arch Review if we didn't end the show with the global countdown. Fernando Augusto Pacheco has flown through the glass right into the studio. Where in the world are we off to, Fernando?
Well, we're going to the United States today. I think it's the most important chart of them all, if I may say that.
And I have to say...
it's quite controversial, but...
well, look, if we're talking pure money, then yes, it is the most important, isn't it? So if you're a record label executive, you might be happy to find what's at number 5, because it's been in the chart for an awfully long time.
Well, exactly. And that's why I chose the American chart this time, because finally we have like fresh blood in the top skeleton of the chart. Because number 5 have Despacito again. It's been there for 36 weeks and it's still doing fairly
36
well.
36 weeks.
It's a lot
still
of time.
Imagine doing anything. Still no one knows what they're on about.
Yeah. I mean, it's going to be Christmas and people will still be singing Despacito, trust me.
It's 8 months.
8 months, exactly.
Eight months. Well, Despacito means slowly, right?
Yeah,
so
slowly.
They got that
so
right. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So this is the version with... So it's Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee featuring Justin Bieber. Exactly. So it's not the version we've been playing here on Monocle 24, is it?
No, no, no. The Americans needed the Justin Bieber.
They needed their own version.
Exactly.
How many versions are there? Just the two?
Just the two. Okay. And I'm sure, and the man outside my flat as well, who plays on the accordion very loud every single day.
Guy. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we have three versions. And number 4, guys, we have an American rapper called Logic with Alessia Cara and Khalid. The song is called 1-800-273-8255. That's the number for the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And, you know, it does talk about teenage suicide, and I've seen the video clip. My God, the first time I saw it, I even cried. You know, it's a very, very bleak video of a kid trying to kill himself. I'm not going to tell the end of the video clip, but you know, it's quite a serious topic. But the song is also very good. That's why it's doing well in the charts.
But it can be difficult when we've got songs, when music videos, when this part, sector of the market, pop, tries to tackle something very seriously, it can be very difficult. Britney Spears tried to do this a number of years ago with that song Every Time, and the video was very much a topic of controversy. A lot of people saying that it was really glamorizing Britney over the top of getting any sort of important message across, whether that was valid or not.
I agree, but I think this one is very different from that Britney video in a way. I think it's done in a very cinematic way. I think, you know, it doesn't, you know, as you were talking before, it doesn't glamorize the whole thing. And it's a great song. And I think Alessia Cara is one of the major pop stars at the moment. She's from Canada. She's a one to watch as well.
Indeed. All right, let's move along then, Fernando. At number three, we have someone else that's no stranger to the charts at all, especially in the US.
Yeah, she was number one last week, not anymore. Taylor Swift, Look What You Made Me Do, which I actually think is quite a good track, especially after, you know, she sampled Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy, so I think that's very good. And, you know, it is a band that I like it very much, and it's a good song, you know. I mean, she, you know, I know she had a lot of haters or people that love her very much, but it's important to have a pop star like this, you know, that creates emotion in people, you know, for positive or negative in some ways.
Jason, does Taylor Swift create emotion in you?
I mean, I do like her. I think there's people writing about things like that and their love life and their diary. And, I mean, I think she ruined Tom Hiddleston. That's for sure. That's the only thing I will say about that. What was going on there, what he did for himself. But, you know, I can't watch him now. I can't take him serious at all. But other than that, but yeah, I wish he'd settle down with a nice young man sometimes. I do think, oh, poor Taylor. But then she'd have nothing to write about, would she?
That's very true. She's a bit like Adele in that respect. All right, number two, Fernando.
That's when the new blood starts to come. It's a rapper called Post Malone. He's a very young rapper in the US, and I think the interesting thing about him, you know, you can't just say he's a rapper. I mean, he does have a lot of grunge country influence on his song as well, and he did this partnership with another rapper, 21 Savage. The song's called Rockstar. I think he has a fantastic beat. I mean, he's doing very well in streaming, so I think the song wouldn't be there just for the sales. That's another interesting thing about the American chart. I think streaming has a major role there, and you know, they're very young. I think they're about like 20, 21. It's a song that came out of nowhere. It's a good one.
Is this the hot, what used to be called the Hot 100?
Oh, it's still.
Because I was never there. There's Billboard charts. There was the Hot 100.
That's the Hot 100, which is part of the Billboard charts.
Okay.
You know? Well, good that you say that. That's the official name, Hot 100. I like it.
You know, all right. I know hot.
Yeah. Give us the hot number one then, Fernando. Who is it?
It is quite hot in every single way. I think, shall we listen to the clip?
Please.
They see pictures, they say ghosts. Bitch, I'm who they tryna be. Look, I might just chill in some babe. I might just chill with your boo. I might just spill on your babe. My pussy feel like a lake. He wanna swim with his face. I'm like, okay. I let him get what he want. He buy me Yves Saint Laurent and the new whip. When I go fast as a horse, I got the trunk in the front. I'm the hottest in the street.
Fernando, there are a few rude words there, I think.
Yeah, I think it's okay. A few rude words time to time. But it's a powerful beat. I think it's a great... I think it personally is a great song. You know, I'm not the biggest rap fan. But it's interesting. Her name is Cardi B, and the song's called Bodak Yellow, Money Moves.
Bodak Yellow, Money
which
Moves.
I was actually researching. There's no meaning for Bodak Yellow. I think she did a game of words because there's another rapper at the moment in the US called Kodak Black. So I think she did a little... She's saying, I'm a yellow rapper.
So it's a response record.
Yeah, I couldn't really understand. I think, you know, that's something that we're going to be discussing for a few weeks now.
That's but, definitely an agenda setter right there, isn't it?
But there's some interesting things. She's the second female rapper in history to be number one without the help of any other featuring artist. Ooh. The other person who did it, I don't know if you guys...
Missy? Quiz time.
Was it Missy Elliott?
Not Missy, actually.
Ooh, I'm going to go for Moni Love.
No, Lauryn Hill, actually.
Oh, of course.
Doo-wop, that thing from 98.
Yeah, was she a rapper? Yes, but she
yeah.
was.
Yeah. I mean... According to Billboard, and I agree with you, it's more of a soul track, you know, that. And what I find interesting, people love talking about women being bitchy to each other, especially those pop stars. But in fact, the most famous female rappers, they congratulate her for number one. Nicki Minaj, Missy Elliott, and Lil' Kim, they send posts like, well done, Cardi B, you know. So I think we should also talk about those more positive stories in a way as well.
Is this a different kind of rap? Is this trap? because this has got a kind of, this sounded like one of the coolest number ones I've heard for yeah. a very long time. It's a right cutting edge. It sounds and really on it.
It's just her. There's no like easy chorus as well. It's just quite a powerful.
I'm not quite sure what trap is because I know it's this new kind of.
And you sound like
rap.
You know what
I
mean, it is.
Yeah,
I mean, you can
I think
just go
I know it when I
this.
Hear it, and I think I just heard it.
I didn't know Jason Solomon's closet rap aficionado over here.
A&R, I did A&R more like. Be signing up people no end.
I didn't know about trap, but yeah, could be trap. You know, it's very trappy.
Well, whether it's trap or not, I think we should take Fernando's advice and say, well done, Cardi B. That does bring us to the end of today's program. Thanks to my guests, Toby Earle and Jason Solomons. This show was produced by Holly Fisher, researched by the music man himself, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And I'm Ben Rylan. To play us out, let's have more of that number one. This is Cardi B with Bodak Yellow. Thanks for listening.
Say, little bitch, you can fuck with me if you wanted to. These expensive, these is red bottoms, these is bloody shoes. Hit the school, I can get them both, I don't want to choose. And I'm quick, cut a nigga off, so don't get comfortable. Look, I don't dance now, I make money move. Say, I don't gotta dance, I make money move. If I see you now, speak.